You know, we have legitimate peace in the Middle East, first time in 3,000 years.
That was President Trump at the White House this week. He's been looking back at his achievements over the past year, some of them real, some of them a little exaggerated, shall we say. And while he's talking about peace, our look back at this week's news has a lot to do with war. Two American soldiers died in that supposedly peaceful Middle East. Japan wants nuclear weapons, Germany approved a whole bunch more military spending, and America is fighting for control of the Caribbean and the world's most crucial sea gate. We'll look at all this and more on today's Trumpet World. Global conflicts reached a record high of 1,450 between January and September this year, according to a report from the German geodata compiler Michael Bauer. That's an increase of 52 conflicts compared to last year. Other conflict trackers show 2024 set a new record for conflict. 2023 did before that. Violence and war is escalating, and of course, the most concerning possible conflicts involve nuclear weapons. Our main story today is about the only victim of nuclear bombs in wartime, now looking at getting a bomb of its own. To get the latest on that, we'll go to our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right, Mr. Palmer. Japan needs nuclear weapons. That is according to a statement Thursday by a source in the Japanese Prime Minister's office. This individual is involved in sculpting Japan's security policy in the government led by Prime Minister Sanae Takaichi. And Takaichi herself has talked about the need for Japan to review its non-nuclear principles. So this is something that's already been on her radar, and now you have a member of her cabinet openly discussing this with reporters. And this comes during a time when Japan has steadily been ramping up its conventional military capabilities. Its total defense-related expenditure now comes to around $70 billion annually after many years of steady increases, so just an eye-watering amount that the Japanese are spending just on their conventional military power. And of course, Japan does have legitimate reasons for wanting to boost its military might and for even wanting to consider adding a nuclear component to its arsenal. You've got China's increasing aggression in the region. You've got Russia as well, just to the north and west there of Japan. You also have the threat from North Korea, which is far from neutralized. And then the United States is no longer viewed as a power that would reliably come to Japan's aid in the event that it was attacked. So there are plenty of legitimate reasons for Japan to seek a nuclear arsenal. But history shows that Japan has an extremely dangerous tendency toward fanatical militarism. The most infamous example of this was before and during World War II. That's when we saw Imperial Japan try to conquer Asia, fueled largely by a Japanese belief that they were racially superior, just kind of a nation of gods destined to rule all men. That toxic faith made Japan's conquests just ruthless beyond words. And we know that nothing short of two atomic bombs was really able to bring an end to Japan's perverse military fanaticism at that time. And World War II is not the only instance of that kind of Japanese fanaticism. History shows that the nation was similarly unhinged during the First Sino-Japanese War, the invasion of Taiwan, the Russo-Japanese War, and really the list goes on. This fanaticism was why the United States and other allied powers forced Japan to renounce war at the end of World War II. And that was why they enshrined pacifism in Japan's constitution with the famous Article 9. But now here we are, 80 years on from the end of World War II, and modern Japan is rapidly abandoning pacifism and marching back toward full militarism, and even talking about developing its own arsenal of unfathomably destructive nuclear weapons. And when we consider all of that chilling history, I think that we should be very concerned by Japan's return to militarism and its desire, you know, openly discussing its need, as it says it, for nuclear weapons. So history really sounds the alarm here, but so does prophecy. Scripture shows that in the final world war, one of the main players will be a tremendously powerful Asian alliance. It'll be led by Russia. But Ezekiel chapter 38 and verse 6 also lists some ancient names for the peoples that make up modern Japan, and shows that they will also be a part of this powerful Asian confederacy. So when we see Japan today quickly abandoning pacifism, any semblance of pacifism really, and rushing toward militarization, it is setting the stage for that prophesied Asian bloc to be just a stunningly strong military power. And we do have a free booklet all about this coming Asian alliance. It's called Russia and China in Prophecy. And there's a whole chapter in there just about Japan's role in this future Asian military alliance. So please, if you don't have a copy of Russia and China in Prophecy, this is a free booklet, and I would encourage you to go to thetrumpet.com and order a copy there.
Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. And I mean, this is probably the most urgent. We talk about nuclear proliferation a fair bit on this show for good reason. And we've had a lot to talk about Iran looking to get a nuclear bomb, Saudi Arabia talking about getting a nuclear bomb. And Japan is probably one of the easiest countries on earth for them to get a nuclear bomb. Like, they have not just nuclear power stations, but one of the most advanced, well-established nuclear civilian industries on the planet. They're very wealthy, very well educated. Like, they know how to make a bomb. There's no scientific research needed. It's probably not really any experimentation needed. Like, they have all of the ingredients. They could have this very, very quickly. I remember reading a news article a few years ago talking about a journalist who was having an interview with someone very senior in the Japanese government. I think it was the defense minister at the time. And they said, well, how long would it take for Japan to get a nuclear bomb if you set your mind to it? And he said that this defense minister, I think it was, basically went into a long explanation of how Japan would never get a bomb. Meanwhile, on the dusty table in front of him, he wrote 6 months. And I've seen that figure quoted a fair bit. 6 months is how long it would potentially take for Japan to get a nuclear weapon.
I've heard it said that because Japan has such an impressive array of world-class physicists, really the highest echelon you could imagine, you know, it's figuratively sometimes said that it's just a screwdriver turn away. All they would have to do is make the decision. The technology is in place. The know-how is, you know, very much in abundance there. And the wealth, as you said, is very much in abundance in Japan as well. So it's just a screwdriver turn away. And that probably would equate to 6 months or somewhere around there. And now you have, you know, this member of the prime minister's cabinet saying, let's turn that screw. Let's turn it.
And as you pointed out, this is the rise of Japan as a major military power. That's something that Herbert W. Armstrong talked about, that's in that book, the Russia and China in Prophecy. But even just the descent in towards nuclear war and man living in this potential where he can wipe itself out. And that in itself is fulfilled prophecy. And in Matthew 24 and verse 21, Jesus Christ talks about a time coming that if God didn't step in, mankind would wipe himself out, which no human mind could have forecast that in the Roman era, when the most destructive weapon was like a catapult or something, that you would reach this position where nuclear weapons could wipe mankind out. And so based on those warnings, Herbert W. Armstrong talked about this a lot. And I just wanted to play a clip from a World Tomorrow program that he gave in 1983. It was after a major it was called The Day After, a TV program aired all about the danger of nuclear war. And he gave then a powerful program warning about the danger of nuclear war.
And I can tell you now that the big fear of nuclear war is not war just between the two great powers. Now, I noticed that most of the men in this discussion, and they were the advisors that have been advising the United States foreign policies and military policies, they seem to think there are only two nations concerned, or two powers, the Soviet Union and the United States. And that's where they are wrong, because the real trouble is going to come from other sources. And it's just too bad that they can't understand the real situation that is going on in the world and understand it better. Now, the one to fear is some small country. And the one who had been in the Holocaust, the Jewish philosopher and author, he had been in that. And he said, I am scared. And he said that the impossible is possible, and it can happen. And he is frightened himself. But he said he was not so much concerned about the two great nations as he is about smaller nations. And if a smaller nation should start, and they have hydrogen bombs, they have atomic weapons, and if a smaller nation should start it, it couldn't be stopped. And these experts agreed that once a nuclear war starts, even if it starts small by a small nation, if some hothead of some smaller nation would start such a war, and they can have possession of nuclear weapons, it could not be stopped. And they were agreed on that, that once it was started, it could not be stopped. Now, I can tell you that it is going to happen. I just read you the prophecy of what is going to happen, but God will stop it. Men can't stop it. Only God could stop it, and he will before it has annihilated all humanity. But it is going to annihilate such a great proportion of humanity until only a part of humanity is going to be left alive. And that's what you're facing in your lifetime, and you're betting your life on it. I not only say you can bet your life on it, you are betting your life on it. God says it is going to happen, but he is going to put an end to it before it goes that far, and therein lies the hope and the only hope in God himself, God Almighty, the Creator, the one who is the power. Invisible though he is, he still is the power that rules everything. Now, God has allowed 6,000 years for men to learn that only a close relationship with God and obedience to God is going to be able to bring us any peace, any happiness, or to give us eternal life. God Almighty has eternal life to give, and he wants to give it to all of us. But we have to come to his way of living. And we are not living his way, we are living man's way, and we are living the way of Satan the devil, who is the real invisible ruler over this earth. And people don't know it because your Bible says all nations have been deceived, honest, sincere, and yet deceived, and don't know the real truth.
So this really is a critical story. It's a warning that we all need to heed, that mankind does live on this knife edge, and that without God, we will wipe ourselves out. And that's a terrifying reality that's so terrifying we just don't think about. But I think we could all do with just more of that understanding that by ourselves, we don't, utter destruction is where our own ways and our own paths lead us. And I think it is a reminder to each of us individually of how much we need God in our life. I'm reminded how much I need to be relying on God, and how self-destructive even my own decisions can be if I'm just relying on myself and my ideas and my quote-unquote wisdom, and how much we need God and his law. So thank you for that important story, Jeremiah. Did you have any other stories from Asia to bring us?
I do, yes. First up, some good news for Taiwan and for those who don't think that aggressors should be able to run roughshod over weaker powers. And that is that on Wednesday, the Trump administration approved a massive arms sale to the Taiwanese, actually the largest ever. There had been some delay on this weapons package and some questioning if it was going to happen at all, since President Trump had given some reason to doubt his stance on Taiwan. But it was approved, and it is a record-breaking package, as I said, worth more than $11 billion. This package includes 420 ATACMS, 60 self-propelled howitzer systems, more than 1,000 javelins, more than 1,500 TOW missiles, and most notably, it includes 82 HIMARS systems. These are the high-mobility artillery rocket systems that have been so vital to Ukraine's ability to defend itself against Russia. And Ukraine has received fewer than half of that number. So for Taiwan to have 82 of these highly capable HIMARS systems is remarkable. You know, for China to invade Taiwan across 100 miles of ocean was always going to be a logistical nightmare and very costly in terms of lives and equipment. But with HIMARS and these other advanced systems now deployed along Taiwan's coasts, the costs for China will go up dramatically. So the question now is about the delivery times. You know, this is a formidable quantity and quality of kit that America is selling to Taiwan, but it'll take time to get it all delivered, especially if isolationist forces in the U.S. government are able to influence the delivery times, as we've seen happen some with Ukrainian equipment. And I think that this news this week could actually prompt the Chinese to feel that they need to make their move before all of this new gear is operational. So, you know, this looks like a very positive development for the rules-based order and like a good day for those who seek to deter lawless aggression. But that will only be the case if we can get this weaponry in place before the Chinese make their move. So we'll see what happens there. And then I just have one final story here about Russian President Vladimir Putin. He said this week that Russia will never back down from its mission to, quote, liberate all historically Russian lands in Ukraine. He said he hopes that it'll happen by a Ukrainian surrender, but if not, then Russia will take it all by military means. He also called Ukraine's European partners pigs. And it's interesting that this comes as President Trump has said that peace is closer than ever for this war, because these words from Putin really don't sound like someone seeking anything less than maximalist ambitions. It is noteworthy, though, and you won't hear this from Putin or from Mr. Trump, but back at the start of the full-scale war in early 2022, Ukraine controlled 23 of its regional capitals and special status cities. Today, Ukraine still controls all 23 of those. Russia has not managed to take a single one in almost 4 years of fighting, and with more than 1.1 million Russian casualties. You know, Russia has managed to take other territory and cities, but none of these well-defended regional capitals and special status cities. So when we hear this kind of talk from Putin saying that he'll take the whole nation, we should recognize that something dramatic would have to change in the dynamic if that's going to be the case. Maybe it would be more direct Chinese involvement or something else, but the current pace is glacial at best. So these kinds of statements from Putin, they may suggest that he has more cards to play and that we may see some sort of significant change in the dynamic soon.
Did you see this story? I didn't see this until just now. This tanker that Ukraine just took out in the Mediterranean, where they've sunk a Russian tanker in the Med. And there's some reports. I'm skeptical of this because it's basically just on social media, but that General Andrei Avanayov, basically a very senior commander in Russia's GRU, military intelligence, has been killed on there. But, I mean, that's a pretty big... I think they've hit an oil platform in the Caspian as well. They're kind of going after Russian assets in the wider region now. So, an interesting development.
Yeah, I've heard the Ukrainians sometimes tire of what they feel is the inefficiency of sanctions from the U.S. and other powers. And so they sometimes use their own sanctions against Russian energy infrastructure, such as this tanker. So yeah, this will be an interesting story to take a look at.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Japan preparing for war. We'll talk about Europe preparing for war in just a moment. But before then, we'll go to the United States. There's a lot of focus on, is war coming with Venezuela? The U.S. announced a blockade on Venezuelan oil this week. But there's also a threat to the Panama Canal and that part of the world from China. And to get the latest from this, we'll go to our U.S. correspondent, Andrew Miller.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The headlines you're probably hearing from the Caribbean region, if you're keeping track down there, have all to do with Donald Trump putting an oil blockade on Venezuela. It's pretty well accepted now that Donald Trump is pushing for regime change in Venezuela. Oil is their most important export. It actually accounts for about 90% of Venezuelan exports and 25% of Venezuela's total gross domestic product. Their strategy is that they, because they're such a pariah nation, they sell the oil to Cuba, which then sells it on the black market down the world, around the world. So Donald Trump's embargo on Venezuela is basically cutting off their economic lifeline to Cuba. In an attempt to get Maduro to agree to flee the country. But what you may not have heard about, a story that's actually just as important, if not more important, is this fight over the Panama Canal. And this fight is between the United States and China. But unlike the fight between the United States and Venezuela, where it's a very direct confrontation with this overt military threat, the fight between the U.S. and China is more of a proxy war involving U.S. and Chinese companies. So to recap, as you probably know, the Panama Canal was dug by the United States under President Theodore Roosevelt back in 1914 and was actually a U.S. territory for pretty much the rest of the 20th century. We gave the Panama Canal back to Panama in 1999 due to an agreement President Jimmy Carter made several years earlier. And China very quickly came in and bought up the ports on both sides of it. Actually, more specifically, a Chinese company called C.K. Hutchison bought up these two ports. Now, when Donald Trump came into office, he very adamantly criticized Jimmy Carter's decision, saying giving back the Panama Canal was one of the stupidest things the U.S. ever did, and floated the idea that since we gave the canal back to be used neutrally by the nation of Panama, we didn't give it to China, we gave it to Panama. If China didn't surrender control of the canal, the U.S. may have to come in and retake it back territorially. Well, under that threat, a deal was almost struck where the U.S. company BlackRock bought those two ports on either end of the Panama Canal, along with 38 other important ports in the region, from the Chinese company C.K. Hutchison. China wasn't too keen on that deal, so they actually struck a term where C.K. Hutchison was actually only going to be one of three buyers. There was going to be another Swiss container company and the Chinese container company, Costco, were each going to get an equal stake. If I understand the terms right, they'd each get a 33% stake. More recently, just recently, China's grown more belligerent, saying that, well, since they got the U.S. to concede to give Costco, their Chinese company, an equal partnership along with this Swiss company and BlackRock, that maybe they could get better terms. So now China's saying they're going to nix the sale completely unless Costco gets controlling stakes. That would mean that the two ports would still be owned by BlackRock, this MSC company from Switzerland, and Costco, but Costco would have the controlling stakes and veto power over how these ports are used. Which to me, I think one of my immediate takeaways from this is this really blows the idea that you've maybe heard that C.K. Hutchison's not actually the Chinese government. It's just a private company from Hong Kong right out of the water. Well, now, There was actually a senior Chinese official that came out and said that the Chinese Communist Party is willing to treat ownership of these ports as part of a larger discussion on trade with the United States over tariffs and other trade agreements. So it's one piece in a bigger trade war between the U.S. and China. That is one thing you have to understand about President Trump's deal-making strategy, is he's not Theodore Roosevelt, who famously said, speak softly and carry a big stick. He's very much of the terms of like, well, speak loudly, and hopefully your loud speech will scare someone into giving you a little better trade deals, with the end deal being much, much, much less than he was saying. Because Trump was talking at the beginning of his term about like, well, the U.S. just needs to go in and actually make Panama a territory again. Then he ended up settling. He was like, okay, well, we're not going to make the Panama Canal a territory. We're just going to give a U.S. company in New York a third of the stakes in the canal. And now China's even trying to call off that deal.
So this is something President Trump commendably has been really focused on. Are they going to do anything about this? He talked a lot about the Panama Canal coming up to a year ago. I don't know whether I've heard anything from the Trump administration for the last 6 months. Is there any coming of that? Is there anything coming of that? And then as well, you know, we know that Venezuela is a China ally. Cuba is a China ally. How much of this is all related as well?
Well, like I said, the Chinese official did say that control over the Panama ports is one bargaining chip between a bigger discussion between the U.S. and China. So it could well be that the fact that Donald Trump, like I said, a year ago, he was talking a bunch about the Panama Canal. More recently, he hasn't made many public statements about it as he focuses more on regime change in Venezuela. Venezuela is a Chinese ally. So China may be upping its game over the Panama ports as part of the deal-making strategy to just give it a lever to influence Donald Trump's actions in Venezuela. I wrote an article with Mr. Jacques a few years ago, preparing to storm America's castle, which just makes a lot of geographic points that the United States is, well, Otto von Bismarck famously said the United States is the most blessed of all the nations because it's surrounded on the north and south by friendly nations and on the east and west by fish. So the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans really protect the United States in a huge way. And then having Canada and the Arctic to the north really protect it. So America's softest spot, it's weak spot in its geographic defenses, is the Gulf of Mexico, or the Gulf of America, as Donald Trump has recently renamed it. And so these foreign powers like China, it's not coincidence that they're trying to get influence in Panama and in Cuba and in Nicaragua and in Venezuela, because it's something like 50% of all U.S. seaborne trade goes within 40 miles of Cuba into the Gulf of Mexico. So this is a hugely important waterway to the United States that Donald Trump recognizes and is trying to get more control over. This is interesting. Our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, wrote a book that's probably going to need to be updated next year once this deal gets concluded. It's titled China's Most Dangerous Move Against America. And it's about C.K. Hutchinson's control of these ports in Panama, specifically highlighting that since Herbert W. Armstrong proved in his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that the United States and Britain are descended from the lost tribes of ancient Israel, specifically Ephraim and Manasseh, the two sons of Joseph, who got the birthright promises passed down to him from his father Isaac, from his father Jacob, from his father Isaac, from his father Abraham, that the United States and Britain are the recipients of the blessings of Abraham. One of those blessings, highlighted in Deuteronomy 28, is these nations would control the gates of their enemies. And on a global scale, a gate is a sea gate. It's these narrow maritime choke points. And then in this book, China's Most Dangerous Move Against America, Mr. Fleury specifies something that he had not specified before, that in Genesis 22, there's a more specific prophecy saying that Abraham's descendants would control the gate of their enemies. So Deuteronomy 28 is plural gate. Genesis 22 is singular gate. And specifying that of all the sea gates that the United States and Britain had controlled, and at one point they controlled almost all of them, the Panama Canal is the most important. It is the gate from Genesis 22. So that understanding tells us that the fact that the United States controlled the Panama Canal is proof that they are the birthright descendants of Abraham, and the fact that they lost it is proof that they've turned away from God, because God told ancient Israel in Deuteronomy 28 that they would lose these birthright gates if they turned away from him. So the fact that America gained and lost the Panama Canal is very significant. We actually even have an article we'll put in the show notes by Mr. Fleury titled "How America Won and Lost the Panama Canal." So we both won it and lost it. Now, President Trump's trying to get it back. And Mr. Fleury has indicated that that's not impossible that he could get it back. There are prophecies in Amos 7 and 2 Kings 14 about a resurgence under an end-time Jeroboam figure. And really, depending on how much this Jeroboam figure submits himself to God, it's possible that that canal could come back. So this is a story we do need to watch closely, because if the Panama Canal is the gate, singular, promised to Abraham in Genesis 22, the fact that America controlled the gate of its enemies is great proof that America is descended from ancient Israel. Actually, Herbert Armstrong wrote at one point in the United States and Britain in Prophecy, which you should definitely read if you have not, that if you didn't know anything about the history of the United States and Britain, other than the fact that they controlled all the sea gates during the 20th century, that fact alone should be enough to prove that they are the descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh. So the fact that America won and lost the Panama Canal is great proof that they are both descended from Abraham and are losing the birthright blessings. So whether or not they get that the canal back is also a great sign of, like, are the birthright blessings going to continue a little longer? Or are these blessings already taken away from us for good?
Great. Well, thank you for that, Andrew, and that important perspective in the conclusion. What else do you have for us from the English-speaking world?
Yeah, a couple other stories. One highlighting just prophecies in Hosea about blood touching blood and how much violence is prophesied to afflict the nation of end times Israel if they turn away from God. Is we've had a number of violent incidences over the past week. A man named Navid Akim and his father murdered at least 15 people and injured 40 in Bondi Beach massacre, and that was in Australia. There have been also another couple of high-profile murders and mass shootings here in the United States, but this massacre in Australia got a lot of headlines. And really, we had a good article go up in one of our morning briefs titled Australia's Guilty Men, showing that even the leadership of Australia is somewhat complicit in these horrible murders, because even though they were conducted by two Islamists against Jewish victims, and the leaders of Australia have come out and condemned the murders and condemned anti-Semitism, these same people doing the condemnation have been the ones espousing some very vile rhetoric against the state of Israel and how the Jews are conducting genocides against the Palestinians, that undoubtedly has played some role in radicalizing Australians against the Jews. So highlighting two important prophecies, one about the blood touching blood and just the general violence afflicting end time Israel, but also about this being Australia, the tribe of Ephraim's in particulars, it's turn away from the tribe of Judah, also prophesied in the book of Isaiah that there would be Ephraim would be against Judah, as you're seeing more anti-Semitism rise in both America and Britain. We got some more revelations about Justice Department corruption here in the United States. We actually did an entire cover story on the Philadelphia Trumpet titled The End of America's Constitutional Republic, about the FBI raid on Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago home a couple years ago, showing how that the federal government was using the FBI to persecute its political enemies and not to uphold the law. Now we've got a new batch of emails seen by Fox News Digital where the FBI agents at the time were admitting that they did not have probable cause to raid Mar-a-Lago, but did it anyway under pressure from the Biden administration. And then one last story about just the staggering amount of government debt and government spending we have in the United States. There's an organization I follow semi-closely called Open the Books that actually does audits on federal spending and highlights government waste. They did a new report out this week saying that the federal government now spends $20,474 per person in the United States. So that spending is 98 times higher than it was in the year 1916, when Woodrow Wilson was president. Almost 100 times higher. Just a huge amount of government spending that goes a long way of explaining why we're running $2 trillion deficits and our debt to GDP ratio is increasing at an alarming level.
Thank you for that, Andrew. Europe's war machine, or Germany's war machine, continues to roll forward. The German Bundestag Budgetary Committee approved another load of military spending this week. The Budgetary Committee is the final authority, really, on that spending. I don't believe it has to go through the full parliament. They approved a record-breaking 30 major defense procurement policies worth around $60 billion. That brings the combined value of defense procurement projects approved this year to about $120 billion. That package includes about 200 Puma infantry fighting vehicles, a new satellite reconnaissance system, maritime drones, Patriot surface-to-air missiles, and I think most interestingly, and what has rightly gathered a lot of the most attention, more spending for the Arrow 3 missile system. We've mentioned this on some previous shows as well, where this is the Israeli-developed system that Germany is relying on to keep it safe from nuclear wet missiles or intercontinental ballistic missiles. This latest agreement, or this expansion of the Arrow 3 system, is valued at $3.1 billion. It's going to complete. So they originally signed up for $3.5 billion. So now they're spending another 3.1, and that combined total is the largest Israeli defense export deal ever. So this is a big deal for Israel, and this is how Germany is looking to defend itself against nuclear weapons. So we talked about this at some length last week, the way that whether it's America, whether it's Judah in the Middle East. It's these nations that this is all about fulfilled prophecy happening before your eyes. All of these nations that the Bible identifies as being the descendants of Israel in the Bible. And Mr. Armstrong shows that clearly in his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. They're all empowering Germany. Whether it's America saying, Germany, you know, Europe, we're backing out. Germany, we want you to take over as NATO number one. And then Israel supplying Germany with all of these weapon systems. So you're getting headlines saying, well, now Israel protects Germany. And Mr. Armstrong was writing about that decades ago in books like The United States and Britain in Prophecy because of specific Bible prophecies. This is happening before your eyes. Also this week, Germany's Federal Cartel Office, they approved a new cooperation between KNDS and Rheinmetall to develop the new Leopard 3 battle tank. Velt said it can be seen as a carte blanche for Rheinmetall's potential takeover of German tank manufacturer KNDS's activities. So they've got this joint go-ahead that's ahead of a Franco-German project that is expected in 2045. It says, what may sound like a mere cooperation to some is in fact nothing less than a revolution in Europe's tank business with far-reaching consequences for the entire market. This is what a lot of people have been saying as Germany spends more on its military and as America pulls out of Europe is like, okay, well, it's all very well and good, Germany spending more, but that just spending more by itself isn't enough to replace America. You also need massive defense conglomerates like you have in the United States. You know, we need German and European Lockheed Martin and Raytheon and General Dynamics and all of these different defense giants that you have in the United States, Boeing. Europe needs more of those. I mean, Europe has EADS and Airbus and some champions like that. But here you see, this is another important part of that European militarization. We're going to have Rheinmetall and KNDS. These are two German companies. Rheinmetall is already a global player in kind of that top league. But now we'll merge them with KNDS. We're building some very significant defense players. And there'll be more on that too. There's still more to be done there, absolutely. But they're doing it. They're moving towards this, becoming this this war machine on a number of fronts. It isn't just about military spending. That is another important step. Meanwhile, what are we doing in Britain? Well, one story that broke this morning is that we spent £70 million doing repairs and doing up an old naval vessel, and then we sold it to Brazil for £20 million. So some fantastic business acumen there from the British government. And that's the kind of defense spending deals we've got. The British government and Sir Keir Starmer have promised big spending from Britain. Sir Keir Starmer, he sounded a bit like Friedrich Merz. You know, Merz and Starmer, they've both been out there talking this big game, saying, yeah, we need to step it up. We're going to spend more. Germany actually is. Meanwhile, Starmer said, nope, he put the brakes on. He said, the defense ministry kind of heard what he was saying, said, great, all right, this is what we'd like to spend it on. And he said, no. Yeah, we'll talk about it in the next year, but it's not happening. The Daily Mail wrote, Britain's defense spending plans were plunged into chaos on Wednesday night after the Prime Minister reportedly blocked a major investment boost. So Germany is building up. Britain, America's backing out. Israel's empowering Germany. And Britain is not really doing much at all. And we're in retreat. It's the 1930s all over again in a great many ways. Okay, not identical, but we're disarming while Germany is arming. And Trumpet executive editor Stephen Flurry has an article this week. Herbert Armstrong was right about Germany. He's had a lot to say on his Trumpet Daily show. I'd really encourage you. You can look that up on YouTube, on Rumble, and go back, see what he's been saying. And he's focused for several days this week on this dramatic turnaround in Europe. And he's written some of that up in Herbert Armstrong was right about Germany. Again, just making the point that all of these things, that every little bit of story, all of these events that we're seeing is exactly what Herbert Armstrong said would happen. And the reason why is because Mr. Armstrong was making those forecasts based on Bible prophecy, based on truth in the Bible. And he said, well, here's a quote, that Mr. Flurry quotes from him in the 1951 Plain Truth. For believe it or not, the United States of Europe, a Winston Churchill dream, an idea sponsored, aided, abetted, and financed by the United States, is the very idea the Pope will seize on, already made, wrapped and labeled, made in the USA, ready to hand over to him. And in promoting this utopian ideal, gullible, trusting America and Britain are creating the Frankenstein that shall destroy them. That's exactly what we're seeing this week. And you can read that article, Herbert Armstrong was right about Germany, on our website, thetrumpet.com. But there's a range of other pretty significant pieces of news from Europe this week. There have been a barrage of meetings as they try to finalize things before everyone goes on holiday around Christmas time for the end of the year. So we saw the EU yesterday kind of take a big step towards becoming a super state, but that was obscured by a pretty major failure. So a lot of discussion, probably the biggest item in discussion in Europe over the last few weeks, has been how to fund Ukraine and how to do it without taking money from European taxpayers. European governments are busy spending on their own military. They don't really want to spend on Ukraine's, and taking money away from taxpayers and giving it to Ukraine isn't a vote winner. So they came up with a plan to take roughly 200 billion euros in frozen Russian assets and give that to Ukraine. It would be called a loan, but a loan that is basically planned to be written off at some point in the future. They don't actually expect it back. And Friedrich Merz, he said this week that the EU would be severely damaged for years if they failed to do this. The European foreign policy chief, Kaja Kallas, she said that there was no plan B. Well, they failed to do it and they adopted a plan B. Pretty humiliating. It's probably a good thing for the EU. If you want to replace the dollar as the world's number one reserve currency, you can't really go around helping yourself to other people's money when you decide you don't like them. But the main reason it failed is because of all the ways the EU falls short of being a super state. The situation was that most of the assets they wanted to seize was in Belgium. At some point down the line, a court or an arbitration tribunal could rule that illegal, and then little Belgium would have to pay the 200 billion euros back. By itself. That's a gargantuan sum for a relatively small country. So Belgium said, okay, well, we'll do it if you promise to bail us out if that happens, that we're not paying this 200 billion all by ourselves and we're all going to pool it and we're all going to pay it together. And Europe said, no, not willing to do that. France in particular. Belgium, if you have to pay, if a court goes in the wrong way, you're on your own. We're not pooling risk that way. And it illustrates a vital point. Being a super state is not just about having a flag, an anthem, a parliament, a court, a president. You know, the EU has those things. But on a very boring, practical level, it comes down to shared debt. Do you share risks? Do you share consequences? Or is it just every nation for itself? And so that's why Europe's plan B is significant. The EU as a whole is going to borrow 90 billion euros and lend that to Ukraine. So we've got shared debt. And the UN or the EU got the thin end of the wedge here during COVID. They agreed to borrow hundreds of billions during COVID. They also agreed to borrow 150 billion euros to finance defense spending across Europe. So we're just seeing this is like the third project now where there's going to be pooled defense spending. This is something that's starting to become very normal, even standard for the EU. Now, it is such a big deal that not everyone went along with it. Hungary, Slovakia, Czech Republic, they all said, we're going to veto the whole thing unless we get an opt-out. So they were allowed to opt out. And this confirms what we've said as well, that Mr. Armstrong talked about it. Well, the Bible talks about Europe being a 10-nation superstate because of those prophecies. Mr. Armstrong made that forecast. They're going to have to shrink down. And we saw that even with this week. But we're seeing events pushing Europe to become this super state. And that was a pretty significant practical step towards that taken by the EU this week. We've also saw a lot of swings on Mercosur, this vital trade deal between Europe and Latin America. It looked dead. Now it looks like it might almost be a done deal. So Giorgia Meloni has been the key figure in this week. Earlier in the week, she said, no, we're not going to sign this deal by the end of the year. And that was seen as her kicking it into the long grass. And France doesn't want it. Italy doesn't want it. Poland doesn't want it. Hungary doesn't want it. So with all of those against it, they'd have enough votes to stop it from happening. Yesterday, though, she kind of came away and said, no, I'm not kicking it into the long grass. She called Brazil's president. Brazil had threatened to walk away from the whole thing in disgust. It was just being delayed yet again, and said, look, I just want one more month and then I will support it. I just need to get a few more concessions, a little more negotiation done, but actually I'm in favor of this. That changes the calculus. If Italy's in favor, they've got a majority. And so now people are a lot more positive about this Mercosur deal. So that's important to watch. This is about creating a trade bloc that can besiege the United States. It gets back to some of what we were just talking about with Andrew. There is an important caveat. This Mercosur deal was split in two with bits of it that can be approved by a qualified majority. Another chunk of it needs unanimity. So the bit that needs everyone to be unanimous is still up in the air. There's also some different shenanigans that could happen in the European Parliament that could delay this for up to 2 years. This is a very important, strategically, prophetically, trade bloc that's going to besiege the United States. Now, Mr. Flurry said he doesn't expect this trade bloc to fully come together until you have Europe being transformed into that Holy Roman Empire, that United States of Europe. That's probably what it will need to take a controversial deal over the finish line. So I think it's interesting to see this move forward, and it's interesting and right in line with Bible prophecy to see the arguing. Another bit of arguing from the EU this week, Friedrich Merz and Germany basically single-handedly turned around the EU on its plan to ban sales of new internal combustion engines by 2035. This was a bonkers plan anyway. I think it was very clear this was never going to happen. Like, just the charging infrastructure for all new cars to be electric, it wasn't on course to happen. You'd need more power stations, more charging points, more miles of cable than we're anywhere close to being rolled out. But a lot of people haven't accepted that yet. I don't think that's become massively obvious yet. The reason why this stopped is because Germany has a big car industry that makes internal combustion engine cars, and they wanted it stopped. And it shows it shows who runs the EU. Germany wants it. Germany makes it happen. Now, related to that, though, German car manufacturers, they announced they had their worst quarter since 2009 in the dark days of the financial crisis. Volkswagen, BMW, and Mercedes-Benz, their combined earnings fell 76% in the third quarter of 2025. The financial consultancy EY labeled Germany the worst performing car manufacturing nation. Chemical industry is at 70% capacity, lowest level since 2002, according to industry figures released earlier this month. They said that this was sending out an SOS signal. Overall, Germany's industrial production is down around 10% from its peak in 2018. So Germany's economy is still heading into crisis. You're kind of seeing crises at the EU level. You know, I mentioned that you've got this merger with KNDS and Rheinmetall. There's a deal to create a new air fighter with France that's kind of falling apart. And this points to another important point that Mr. Armstrong talked about a lot, is that it will take crisis to force Europe to come together as this superstate. I mean, you saw the way that they couldn't really agree on this debt pooling. All of that is pushing towards this coming crisis. So that's an important story to keep watching. It's not going to be smooth sailing. I mean, there are people, George Friedman, I mentioned, he says, well, look, Europe's got two paths ahead of it now that America's pulling out. They can unite and become a super state and become a major power, or they can fall apart and be irrelevant. And he said, I tend to think it looks like they'll fall apart and become irrelevant. And that is the way that they're drifting. But it's going to take a crisis, and it will take something that's really going to shake them for them to come together as a superstate. And the Catholic Church is also going to play a major role in providing the binding force they've not been able to find so far. Well, one last story. This was highlighted by the Times of Israel over the weekend. Two-thirds of Germany's first post-Nazi chancellery were former Nazis, according to a study into the chancellery published earlier this year. I didn't really notice it at the time. Not many outlets covered it, but the Times of Israel had a really good article drawing attention to it. This is part of a trend that we've seen over the last 15 years or so, where various different German government departments have commissioned investigations into the immediate post-war era and found them thoroughly infiltrated and full of Nazis. So in this particular department in the chancellery, well, generally across the whole government, what you found is former Nazis were prevalent in large numbers. And then also you'd have a huge number of staff, like most of the staff worked for the Nazis during the Second World War. After the war ended, they said, no, like, I wasn't really a Nazi. In fact, I was trying to slow the Nazis down behind the scenes and throw sand in the wheels. And I saved a lot of lives, actually. And all of these investigations discovered that was a lie. They were enthusiastic Nazis. They claimed they weren't. They kept their jobs. And all of these government departments were stuffed with enthusiastic Nazis. And the German chancellery was no different. The chancellery, West German Democracy in the Nazi Past, was the name of the study. It found that of the 50 people born before 1918 and that worked for Konrad Adenauer, the first post-war chancellor, only three had resisted the Nazis. Now, the rest had supported them or even joined them. A lot had been part of things like the Gestapo and the SS. They found that Adenauer built post-war Germany with the help with lawyers who implemented the anti-Semitic Nuremberg laws, civil servants that helped the German state take the property of Jews murdered in the Holocaust, journalists and filmmakers who made propaganda under Joseph Goebbels. Lots of people that went on to kind of work in the German embassy, they'd been propagandists for Goebbels. And then they spent those next few decades annoyed that in Hollywood, the Germans and the Nazis were the bad guys. And as this report talked about, they were more concerned about how Nazis were portrayed in American popular culture than they were about the perspective of the victims or anything like that. They included a quote from a 1965 memo where one of these diplomats complained that Nazis were portrayed as the bad guys only thanks to, quote, the type of Jewish liberal who has great influence in the modern communications industry. So even in the 1960s, you had people working at the top of the German chancellery who were saying, well, the Nazis weren't bad. It's just they're portrayed negatively because of the Jews. And this should cause a lot more people to start asking big questions about, well, are we sure we really want Germany to lead NATO in Europe and take over control? Like, might they turn against us? Might there be something underground there in Germany if there was no real or not much in the way of repentance and change after World War II and a lot of continuity and a lot of staff and the German state was really built by former Nazis? Maybe we should pause for thought. And Herbert W. Armstrong, again, he forecast this exactly in May 1945. We don't understand German thoroughness, he wrote. From the very start of World War II, they've considered the possibility of losing this second round as they did the first, and they have carefully, methodically planned in such an eventuality the third round, World War III. This round of war in Europe is over, and the Nazis have now gone underground. And he said they plan to come back and win on the third try. And we know for a fact he was right, that they did go underground. And the most notorious fled to Latin America. And that's part of the groundwork then that you'll see more of when you have this EU Mercosur deal and the Holy Roman Empire working with Latin America. And then the ones that weren't as high profile, well, they stayed underground within the German government and helped those others get away and steer the post-war government. So people are acknowledging the facts of the case, but they're not asking, what does this mean? And they really should as they watch Germany rise back up. So again, I'll just notice that, mention that article. This is another way that Herbert Armstrong was right about Germany, as Mr. Stephen Flurry wrote this week. And again, you can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. So a lot going on in Europe this week. Well, now we'll turn to the supposedly peaceful Middle East, at peace, according to Donald Trump, for the first time in 3,000 years, and get an update on what's been going on with U.S. military personnel in Syria from our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic.
Yes, on Saturday last week, a gunman in Syria killed two U.S. servicemen and a contracted American interpreter. It's the first U.S. fatalities in Syria since the fall of the Assad regime last year. It took place near the ancient city of Palmyra, which several years ago, ISIS was famous for demolishing several historical ruins there. According to the U.S. military, this killer was associated with ISIS. They called him a lone ISIS gunman. He was killed in the resulting skirmish. There was a meeting between U.S. forces and the forces of the current Syrian government happening nearby that apparently this figure wanted to derail. But even though the U.S. military is saying belongs to ISIS, he had another affiliation that was with the Syrian government itself. The man was, according to the Wall Street Journal, quote, a member of the Syrian security forces who was set to be fired for holding extremist views. The journal cited a spokesman for the Interior Ministry that gave an interview in Syria. Their paraphrase, quote, the assailant had been suspected of extremist sympathies in an evaluation issued on December 10th and was set to be dismissed from the security forces on Sunday, the day after the attack, end quote. So maybe you couldn't necessarily blame, like, the Syrian government probably did not tell this guy to do any of this, but they still knew what he was doing, and they knew enough of what he believed to fire him, and at the very least there's some negligence there of letting this attack go forward. But I think it also shows an example on the kind of people that sign up to the Syrian government to work for them. We've spoken on this program many, many times about the President Ahmed al-Sharaa and how he used to lead a branch of al-Qaeda in Syria. Thousands of people from around the world, from Muslim areas, have went to Syria to fight for him because they believed in global jihad, because they believed in his vision for an Islamist state in Syria. A lot of those people, with approval of the Trump administration, were grafted into Syria's military and are now part of the government. There's a lot of discussion about how moderate he's become, how he's switched his military gear for a suit and tie, how he's not the emir of this terror group anymore, now that he's President Sharaa. But even if he has moderated his views, and that's doubtful, there's many, many people under him that have not moderated their views, that have stuck around in Syria clinging to their old visions. And the prophecy we keep going to over and over on this show is in Psalm 83, which discusses the end-time nations of Israel, which, as Andrew brought out, involved the United States and Britain. But it specifically discusses a group of countries allied against them. Verse 4 states that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. And that prophecy, verses 6 through 8, talk about the different peoples that will be involved in that alliance, and it specifically mentions the Hagarenes, or the ancient inhabitants of Syria. And because of that, Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has said that Syria is going to play a part in this alliance. And we've discussed on this program before about how the new government in Syria, the new regime change there, is helping bring that about. And regardless of what President Trump or anybody else says in front of the news cameras, this regime is still radical, still holds radical views, and there's enough people working for the regime that want to go to the American servicemen in Syria and attack them. Last month, our executive editor, Mr. Stephen Fleury, wrote an article called A Terrorist in the White House about Sharaa's visit to Washington, and goes into a bit more of the unsavory links and what that means for America going forward. If people would like to learn more about the context of this attack and what we expect in the future, I recommend they go and read that. We can put a link in the show notes.
Thank you very much for that, Mahalo. Thank you for all of you for joining us today. I wanted to conclude with one more clip from that same program by Herbert W. Armstrong. Here he is, again, going back to an important lesson that we need to draw from the violence, from the destruction, the threat of nuclear war all around us.
The ministers are teaching the law of God is done away, and the law of God is God's way of life, the way to peace, the way to happiness and joy. But they don't like especially the part that is important to God, that honors Him. And so they say the law is done away, you don't have to obey it any longer. This one voice has to cry out of what is going to happen to this people if we don't turn to God. There has to be a turning to God and not to more military weapons. I'm not in the argument for or against further nuclear weapons. I'm just telling you the place of security is God Himself. And surrendering to God to obey His commandments, His laws, a good understanding of all they that keep his commandments. And if any man says, I know him, and keeps not his commandments, that man is a liar, says God in 1 John the 2nd chapter, and I believe it's verse 4. So this voice is crying out.
All of this news is designed to point us to God and to demonstrate our need to rely on him, to keep his law, and then there is a sure protection and safety in him, as Mr. Armstrong talked about. Well, that is about all that we've got time for, probably more than we have time for looking at the clock here. But thank you for sticking with us. Thank you to George Haddad, Matthew Friesen, and Jacob Hessong for engineering and production. If you have any questions, any comments, please do get in touch with us. Trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. Please do give us a like or subscribe, no matter where you're listening, or leave us a comment. We'll be back next week. Until then, keep watching your world.